Okay, so clearly we can't read through all 52 sections of Leaves of Grass in class, or it would take the rest of the semester. It would be totally cool. We would never get bored, but we have other fish to fry. So we're going to start doing some fast forwarding here. I believe we left off in class around the bottom of 117. Now at home, you're reading the whole thing. If you've not finished reading the whole thing at home, I'd like you to finish by Thursday, okay? Yes, all 52 sections, yes. Okay, so we're at the bottom of 117, in the middle of section 3. Urge and urge and urge. This line I always hear in Mick Jagger's voice for some reason, you know? I mean, it's completely sexual. It's completely, you know, it makes sense. There's no Mick Jagger without Walt Whitman. There's no rock and roll without Walt Whitman, right? Rock and roll has a sexual beat. It has a sexual subtext to it, as does jazz. Do you know about this word jazz? It's actually quite a mysterious word. No one knows exactly where it came from, except that it appears to be derived from a slang term for male ejaculate. It's cognate with the term that's still around, jism. Yeah, jizz, jazz. Thank you very much. Yes, yes. And congratulations to you.
Once again, that's yes. Recorder.
Right. It was called jazz music, possibly because it originated in the whorehouses of New Orleans. And it was music to make people shake their booty. It was music that early jazz everyone danced to. And it was not George and Martha Washington dancing the minuet, you know, in that rigid formal thing, but it was where you moved everything. You used all the parts of the body that you use when you're having sexual intercourse. It's a sexually energized music. Rock and roll is, jazz is, and here's Whitman making that happen in poetry before it happens in music, actually. Before it happens in American music, come to think of it. Or at least in white people's American music. We see this even in the picture. You've got these pictures in your assignment sheet. You don't have it?
Yeah.
Okay. So here we got our photos of, you know, three important American poets in the mid-19th century. Emily Dickinson on one side, Edgar Allan Poe on the other side. These are typical portraits of poets. And in the middle is the engraving of Whitman that was the frontispiece of the first edition of Leaves of Grass, which he published himself in 1855. Because of his background working in printing offices and newspapers, he was able to, you know, to typeset the whole thing himself, do the whole thing himself. And he didn't do the engraving, someone else did it, but the engraving makes a statement. How is this picture different from your typical picture of a poet here? Yeah, more like a snapshot, and in what sense?
More like the common man.
Yeah, well, look at his clothing. Whereas Poe, and you've recalled pictures of Emerson, and even Thoreau. Even Thoreau, that perpetual graduate student who refused to hold down a job, even Thoreau in his one of the two photos that we have of him, he's wearing a formal collar and a coat. And here is Whitman wearing a peasant blouse open at the neck, wearing a country hat, like a straw hat. What else about the photo? Yeah, Otis?
His whole body as opposed to just his face.
That's right. That's right. It's his whole, it's his pelvis is included. Not just his head, because this is not just poetry coming from the head, or even poetry coming from the head and the heart, but from the head and the heart and the pelvis. Yeah, what else?
Not actually expressionless, he has a scabbard.
Yeah, there's a very interesting expression. I know that this is a small reproduction here. But there's a, you know, the way his head is cocked to the side, the way he's kind of looking at the viewer out of the askance, you know, maybe it's kind of a defiant look, maybe kind of a seductive look, maybe it's kind of bedroom eyes. What else? What about his posture? Yeah, one fist on the hip, the other hand in the pocket, and notice that he's not standing straight. He has got his weight shifted to the left foot, which puts his pelvis at a tilt.
It's almost like a...
It's a casual, it's a slacker pose. Yeah.
Well, I think of photos with people with hands on their hips leaning to one side of them. It's more of like a feminine image to me than it is a
Hmm, interesting.
A lot of pictures, if some of you described that pose to me,
yeah,
and didn't tell me the gender of the person, I would guess that the person was...
Interesting, interesting. There is a kind of androgynous thing going on here. Interestingly enough, again, if you go into the history of music, and even before that, theater, everything, when you get a big, a lot of the big sex symbols have an androgynous quality to them. A lot of the early rock and roll was sung very, you know, like Little Richard doing that, you know, which was then picked up by the Beatles, which is possibly helped make, maybe that's part of what made them in a way, like they could be very erotic, very sexual, and yet somehow non-threatening by being high voice. Maybe that's part of the deal. In the theater in Shakespeare's time, when there were no actresses, and all the, you know, all the Juliet and all the other female roles were played by pretty boys in drag, that was a very big part of the whole theater-going experience, to see some pretty boy dressed up as Juliet, who's been trained how to wear the wig and wear the clothes and wear the makeup and carry himself and stand in the stance, as you're saying, Otis, and to be so pretty and so seductive that you're ready to allow yourself to forget that it's a male. That was part of the whole game, part of the art form. So yeah, there may be that. I thank you for pointing that out, Otis. I never thought of this way before. But yeah, there is this androgynous quality, which is appropriate for Whitman, isn't it? You know, because his whole sexual persona is in the poetry as well as his life is so bisexual, at least. Okay, so. So the history of it is, you saw this in the film, but just to recap the important stuff. So he puts out the first edition of Leaves of Grass in 1855. And it's fairly successful. And the rest of his life, all he does is he publishes revised, expanded editions of Leaves of Grass.
I thought the movie said that everyone was just slammed.
Well, that too. I'll get to that in a second. But getting slammed is not necessarily a bad thing. It means you're getting noticed.
Yeah.
Jane Mansfield, the big sexy Hollywood goddess of the 50s, said, I think it was Jane Mansfield, said, there's no such thing as bad publicity. Yeah. So he puts out Leaves of Grass and keeps revising it, expanding it the rest of his life. The last edition is known as the Deathbed Edition. He was literally working on it as he was dying. That's the one that usually is taken to be his final word. So I believe the text that we're reading here is from the Deathbed Edition. Scholars like to argue about, you know, which is the best edition. Usually they go with the Deathbed Edition. There are some scholars who feel that the very first edition was the real pure vision, and he should have stopped it. For example, in the 1855 edition, the first line reads, "I celebrate myself." Then in a later edition, he added, "and sing myself." Now we could spend many hours, you know, breaking that down. Why do you have to add "and sing myself"?
I kind of like it better just "I celebrate myself."
Yeah. I celebrate myself maybe that's more of what? You know, maybe that's just more the pure experience. Oh, I'm walking around. Hey, it's cool being me. It's cool being. And then said, and sing myself. Well, and now I'm going to be a poet about it.
Sing almost means like you're telling others.
You're
making it more public.
Yeah. Exactly. You're making it public. You're publishing it. There's a little bit of self with a small s, self-consciousness about the thing.
Like
perhaps.
Vulnerability.
How so?
Well, it's like when you kind of sing in front of people, you're really vulnerable because anything they decide to say about you, it's going to probably affect how you feel about your own.
Yes. Some people. I don't know about Whitman.
True,
you know,
true.
So I don't know about Whitman. He's pretty, seems pretty bold. At least the persona that we get in the poem is. Now Whitman was also bold about self-promotion. And so when he published the first edition, he sent a complimentary copy to Ralph Waldo Emerson. This was in the film, right? And Emerson writes back and says, this is 10 years after Emerson wrote that essay, The Poet. Yeah, Victor?
Well, I have a question about
that. Okay. Yeah.
Can I ask you? It said in the movie that he realized that Emerson sent the letter and like, it was for his eyes only.
Yes.
And why did he publish it?
Well, this is exactly, it's quite hilarious, you're right, because he was not shy about promoting himself. What Emerson writes back the letter and basically says, you're the guy that I predicted in my essay, The Poet, 10 years ago. You're the guy we've been waiting for, the guy who reflects the soul of the nation back to itself in his poetry. And Whitman goes, cool, I got to use this, and he puts it in ads.
Well, wouldn't Emerson get mad at that?
Yeah.
He wrote
yeah.
Or he wrote the reviews that were like, this is terrible, and
Well, eventually what happens is Emerson backs off of, as in the later editions, as the erotic element in here gets more red hot, Emerson just decides it's too much for him. He tries to get Whitman to tone down the sexual element. Whitman won't. And so essentially he withdraws his endorsement. So let's look at some of this. The other thing is in the original edition, A Song of Myself takes up, you know, something like two-thirds or three-quarters of the book. It's not called Song of Myself in the original edition. It doesn't even have that title. But in the later editions, it gets that title. And in the later editions, he keeps adding more and more poems to the book Leaves of Grass. So let's go back to the bottom of 117. Urge and urge and urge, always the procreant, that is the sexual, urge of the world, out of the dimness, opposite equals advance, always substance and increase, always sex. And I think we talked about this last week, this idea of, you know, out of the dimness, opposite equals advance. It's almost as if he's stating a universal law, a law of physics.
That is a law.
Yeah?
It's
the third what?
Law.
Of what?
Who's?
Newton's.
Oh, uh-huh. There you go. And what year did Newton's articulate that?
Newton.
I'm sorry? Okay, good. So that was around when, but can you see how in the context he puts it in, he's talking about, you know, out of the dimness, that's man and woman groping for each other in the bed, at the same time that it's the proton and the electron, you know, forming their atomic bonds or whatever the heck they do. It's day and night. It's birth and death. It's everything. So when we participate in sexuality, we're just participating in the dance of the universe. Always a knit of identity, always distinction. Always a breed of life, right? Identity, distinction. We're all the same, but we're all different. It's all the ocean, but it's also individual waves. To elaborate is no avail. Learned and unlearned feel that it is so. What does that mean? To elaborate is no avail.
Can you explain this feeling?
You can't explain it. You're not going to convince anyone intellectually. We just have to know it intuitively. It's just It's just obvious. How can you explain that 2 plus 2 always has to be 4? You can't. Okay. Let's skip. We have to start fast-forwarding a little. Skip the next little section. And to this one line by itself is huge. Clear and sweet is my soul, and clear and sweet is all that is not my soul. Boy, I hope Nathaniel Hawthorne read that. I wish Arthur Dimmesdale and Hester Prynne could have read that. That would have changed everything if they could have read that and gotten it, right? Because what's the Puritan position? Clear and sweet is my soul, and wretched and damned and dangerous and horrible is everything that is not my soul. Lack one, lacks both, right? You can't have one without the other. Lack one, lacks both. And the unseen is proved by the seen. What does that mean in this context? What's the unseen? God, or the soul, the essence, the awareness, the emptiness, Brahman, the oversoul. And what is the seen? The world, the body. The spirit is not opposed to the body. The spirit is proved by the body. God is proved by the world. In the Heart Sutra, which is the most important text of Mahayana Buddhism, and the most important line in it is, form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. What? What? How can that be? They're opposites. Form, the world, the body. The whole form of the universe is none other than emptiness, is the essence, is the nothing, the God, the no thing. How can all the things be the same as no thing? Yeah, and vice versa. Remember when you were a little kid, and being an intelligent little kid, maybe around the age of 6, you started asking questions, where does everything come from? You started wondering, how can we get all this something out of nothing? Am I the only one who, like, at age of 6, like, was sitting around all the time trying to figure that out? How do we get all this something out of nothing? Of course, I didn't. You had some of that. Yeah. Of course, I didn't have any religious training. If I'd been sent to Sunday school, I would have had the Sunday school teacher to tell me, well, it comes from God. Now, if you were there and then you were also a troublemaking little 6-year-old, you say, where did God come from? That's when the Sunday school teacher said, time for juice and cookies. Now, what Buddhism said is you were right at the age of 6. To throw, you know, the whole reason, why does God have to be put into the equation? Doesn't that just make the equation less elegant in mathematical terms? If something can come out of nothing, why not have the universe come out of nothing? But because it can't. It can't. How can all this something come out of nothing? And what the Heart Sutra is saying there is, yeah, you were right. Something can't come out of nothing. Something is nothing. Everything is nothing. Form is no other than emptiness. It's just kind of emptiness in drag. It's emptiness acting like form. Dancing around so it looks like form. The way light dances around on a screen and looks like a movie. The Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra. S-U-T-R-A. S-U-T-R-A.
Like heart, like human.
Heart, yeah, because it's like considered the heart of the teaching.
Is it one word?
The Heart. The Heart Sutra. Yeah, it's an amazing text. Read it up. You should look it up sometime.
Buddhist?
Yeah. Those of you who take a Lit of Enlightenment class will be breaking down the whole Heart Sutra. Now, did Whitman read the Heart Sutra? Probably not. You know, when Thoreau had his famous encounter with Whitman, and he asked him, "Well, have you read the Eastern Scriptures? Have you read?" He may have even said, "Have you read the Upanishads?" And Whitman said, "No. You have to tell me about them." But he may have been lying. because artists all like to be original geniuses. Artists all like to claim that they didn't have any sources. So we don't know. Or did he just see that without reading it anywhere? Next little section. Welcome is every organ and attribute of me, and of any man health hearty and clean. Not an inch nor a particle of an inch is vile, and none shall be less familiar than the rest. This is a huge statement to me, Bacon, in the middle of the Victorian age. I told you, I think, last week about that Far Side cartoon. You know, God saying to Adam and Eve, remember, you're made in my image, and parts of you are dirty. You know, it's such an absurd notion, and yet that's the way we think. That's the way we think. And here he is defying that, saying, you know, and you see the connection. If all they form is the expression of emptiness, if all the waves of physical manifestation, including my body, are the expression of the infinite, the expression of God, if you want to use that word, how can any part of my body be not sacred, not holy? How can it be not only not holy, how can it be vile? Ooh, those are your, what do they call them in England? The naughty bits. It's such an absurd notion. And here is Whitman standing on the rooftops proclaiming this. And this now brings us to Allen Ginsberg. Here's a photo of Allen Ginsberg when he read his poetry at Pingree in 1991. A couple of Pingree teachers and students. Here's Mike Masiosi, Ted's brother, standing in the back row.
Wow.
Old student of mine.
Cool.
Yes. And here's Ginsberg's collected poems, which he very nicely signed for me on that day. Ginsberg is really kind of the spiritual and poetic grandson, we could say, of Whitman. He writes very much in Whitman's style, same kind of free verse style. And the same themes, only writing 100 years later, writing in the 1950s instead of the 1850s. He was a very important member of the Beats, the Beat writers. Here's, many of you have read Jack Kerouac. He's probably the best known of the Beat writers. This is a photograph taken by Allen Ginsberg. Of course, Kerouac is mainly a novelist. Ginsberg, a poet. So, Ginsberg, now, here's a problem. When you're writing free verse and you don't have meter and you don't have rhyme to hold the poem together, what do you use to hold the poem together?
Spacing or breaks?
Well, you use the, well, that's the expression of the breath. You use the breath. It's music. It's like, it's, you know, it's Coltrane saxophone solo, and there's got to be a breath at the beginning of every line. You have to read this stuff out loud to get it. So yeah, he does that, but the other thing that he does, if you look for a moment, go to page 126. Section 15. We can imagine him riding up and down Broadway in the omnibus, seeing all these different, well, some of this he would have been able to see in New York, some's in the countryside. But if you look down the left-hand side of the page, you see the repetition of the word the. And then each line is a little vignette, right? A little picture. The pure contralto, you know what a contralto is, a singer, it's a woman with a deep voice. Sings in the organ loft, the carpenter, blah, 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 the married and unmarried children, blah, 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 the pilot, blah, blah, blah. So each line is a different person in a different situation doing a different thing, and it's all held together by that repeating structure of the blah, blah, blah. Okay, some word or phrase repeated holds it together. Now, you'll see in what I'm about to read you that Ginsberg uses the same device, technically, to hold it together. And he's writing on the same theme, this theme that everything is sacred, everything is holy, including every what does he say? Not an inch nor a particle of an inch of is vile. This is called Footnote to Howell. By far, Ginsberg's most famous work is Howell, which you must read someday. Howell has been called the Beat Declaration of Independence. But Howell is quite long. I'm going to read you a footnote to Howell, which he wrote a little bit later. Holy, 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 holy. The world is holy. The soul is holy. The skin is holy. The nose is holy. The tongue and cock and hand and asshole holy. Yes, and it is funny, and he gets the joke. He's not, you know, retarded. But also, if you're following Whitman's logic, it has to be true. And the logic of the Heart Sutra, it has to be true. Everything is holy. Everybody's holy. Everywhere is holy. Every day is in eternity. Every man's an angel. The bum's as holy as the seraphim. The madman is holy as you, my soul, are holy. The typewriter is holy. The poem is holy. The voice is holy. The hearers are holy. The ecstasy is holy. Now he's looking around the room, seeing all his friends. Holy Peter, holy Alan, holy Solomon, holy Lucian, holy Kerouac, holy Hunky, holy Burroughs, holy Cassidy. Holy the unknown, buggered and suffering beggars. Holy the hideous human angels. Holy my mother in the insane asylum. Yeah, well, that's some autobiography. She was, in fact, in an insane asylum. And now my favorite line, I think, in this poem. Holy the cocks of the grandfathers of Kansas. Yeah. Holy the groaning saxophone. Holy the bop apocalypse. Holy the jazz bands, marijuana hipsters, peace, peyote, pipes, and drums. Holy the solitudes of skyscrapers and pavements. Holy the cafeterias filled with the millions. Holy the mysterious rivers of tears under the streets. Holy the lone juggernaut. Holy the vast lamb of the middle class. Holy the crazy shepherds of rebellion who digs Los Angeles is Los Angeles. Holy New York, holy San Francisco, holy Peoria and Seattle, holy Paris, holy Tangier, holy Moscow, holy Istanbul, holy time and eternity, holy eternity and time, holy the clocks in space, holy the fourth dimension, holy the fifth international, holy the angel in Moloch, holy the sea, holy the desert, holy the railroad, holy the locomotive, holy the visions, holy the hallucinations, holy the miracles, holy the eyeball, holy the abyss, holy forgiveness, mercy, charity, faith, holy hours, bodies, suffering, magnanimity, holy the supernatural, extra brilliant, intelligent kindness of the soul. So if Whitman had been around in the 1950s, in the era of jazz and marijuana, he'd probably be writing something like that. I think clearly that Ginsberg's doing that. So you see the influence coming down. Let's go ahead. Let's look at section 5. Section 5 starts with the same idea, stated in a different way, the form and emptiness. I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. This is section 5, page 119. Loaf with me on the grass. By the way, I did a little bit of research on that word loaf, meaning to, you know, laze around. That was a brand new slang word in Whitman's day. So he's cutting edge here. He's using language that probably the old people in the older generation would say, what's he talking about? which of course is, that's part of the function of slang. It's to be new, it's to be fresh, for the old people to shake their heads and be confused by. Loaf with me on the grass, loose the stop from your throat. Not words, not music or rhyme I want, not custom or lecture, not even the best. Right? Anything that's custom, anything that's accustomed, anything that's not fresh, new, brand new, even the best. No. I'm going to be fresh, alive, spontaneous, in the moment. Only the lull I like, the hum of your velvet voice. And then he goes into a little memory here, describing an act. And an act that I think shocked Ralph Waldo Emerson. See if you can figure out what's going on here. I mind how once we lay such a transparent summer morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips. Athwart means across. Okay, everyone visualizing here? How you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me. Oh, thank you. This is a description of, I hope everyone understands, this is a description of fellatio. Okay, he's receiving a blowjob here. In case, for those of you who don't speak Latin. Now, of course, to say it that way, to say it that way makes it sound, you know, dirty, sniggering kind of thing, which is not what Whitman is about at all. He's doing it right there in the context of, you know, the body and the soul are one and the same and are sacred, right? And parted the shirt from, and look at just the beauty of this gesture here, and parted the shirt from my bosom bone and plunged your tongue to my bare-stripped heart and reached till you felt my beard and reached till you held my feet. Swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that pass all the argument of the earth. He's echoing the Bible there. Any of you know that line from St. Paul? St. Paul talks about the peace of God which passeth all understanding. Right? Again, you can't logic your way to it. There's no reason. Okay, X, Y, Z, therefore, Z prime, therefore I am at peace. It doesn't work that way. It's the peace of God which passeth all understanding. Surpasseth, transcends all understanding, all logic. Swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that pass all the argument of the earth. Right? So where is he deriving that transcendental peace? You know, apparently in the context of this sexual act. Because the sexual act is a sacred act. It's a way of communing with the sacred. You know, when you're praying, when you're meditating, you're not thinking a lot of thoughts if the prayer is working. When you're engaged in a sexual act, you're also not thinking a lot of thoughts. They're both transcendental acts. They're both taking you beyond thought. And I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own, and I know that the Spirit of God is the brother of my own, and that all the men ever born are also my brothers, and the women my sisters and lovers. So, this is what he gets. This is what Whitman gets out of an act of oral sex. He gets this vision of the oneness of everyone with each other and with God. That's pretty good stuff. Section 7. I'm just, you know, read all this stuff thoroughly on your own. It's just a crime to be zooming through it, but we have to. Section 7, I just want to point out the first couple of lines. Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. Would most people say it's just as lucky to die as it is to be born? No. If you think you're the leaf, it's really a tragedy. We've talked about this, to fall off the tree. If you know you're not just the leaf, you're the tree, you're the valley, you're the universe. then the falling of a leaf is, that's all part of the process. It's fine. But notice, it's just as lucky to die, and I know it. Not I believe it, not I think it, not I. It makes sense to me logically. I know it. That deep, intuitive, irrefutable knowledge. I see it. I pass death with the dying, right? He gets it. He experiences this stuff through his incredible power of empathetic imagination. Empathetic imagination. He experiences everything along with everyone else. I pass. I pass death with the dying and birth with the new washed babe and am not contained between my hat and boots. One of my favorite lines from Whitman there. I'm not contained between my hat and boots. Right? I mean, you can just about taste that boundlessness there, can't you? Okay, section 11. Resuming, section 11. Twenty-eight young men bathe by the shore. 28 young men and all so friendly. 28 years of womanly life and all so lonesome. She owns the fine house by the rise of the bank. She hides handsome and richly dressed aft the blinds of the window. Aft means behind. So you're getting the picture here? It's 28 guys bathing naked in the river. And this 28-year-old spinster, virgin, that's quite old to be unmarried and a virgin in that culture. There she is. It's kind of a voyeuristic thing. She's peekabooing, you know, through the blinds, the curtains, the blinds, you know, looking at these guys. Now, the fact that there's 28 of them and that she's 28 years old, what does that do? Yes. There's the oneness. There's the connectedness of them. See, that's a little sleight of hand there that you do with poetry. Making it the same number. Now, of all the numbers that it could be, why 28? What is 28? What else is 28? It's the days in February, and originally it was the days in all the month before Julius Caesar and Augustus Caesar started wanting extra days to make their month, the July and August, longer. On the lunar calendar, every month was 28, and is on a lunar calendar, 28 days, because that's how long it takes the moon to do one cycle of its phases. And that's how is that connected with women? Oh, yes, it's the menstrual cycle. So here we get, in the 28, we get it's like the tides that move with the moon, and by implication, all the cosmic forces, all the planets and the atoms and the photons and the electrons, and a part of that is a woman's biological tides, which every month are implanting an egg and saying, come here, Big Daddy, and fertilize this thing. Okay. I mean, look, ladies, you all have a gazillion years of biological programming telling you that, trying to make that your strongest urge. And gentlemen, you all have a gazillion years of biological programming making your strongest urge to spread your seed as far and wide as possible. That's how the race gets propagated. And all this social stuff that is getting you to not do that, to not have babies before you go through college and get married, is this very, very thin veneer of civilization. You know, very, very thin. It's about the thickness of a condom, right? It's between you and your bio programming. Okay, now here he's given us the bio programming full out. By the way, when you hear all those crickets and locusts at night in the height of summer making all that wonderful sound, you know what they're all saying? They're all saying, come here, baby. Those are mating calls. Those are mating calls. Every one of them saying, do me, do me, do me. Yeah. No, No. And I say this again, not to make it a sniggering, dirty joke, but to make the Whitman-esque point that the universe, nature, it's all sexual. Okay, let's go. We got to go quickly here. Which of the young men does she like the best? Ah, the homeliest of them is beautiful to her. Where are you off to, lady? For I see you. You splash in the water there, yet stay stock still in your room. Well, how can that be? How can she be both?
Her mind is in the water?
Yes, it's through her power of imagination. She's actually still behind the blind. But through the power of her imagination, she's there in the water with them. And meanwhile, by the power of Whitman's imagination, he's there with her. He's creating this whole scene. And by the power of our imagination, we're able to recreate it all. Dashing and laughing along the beach came the 29th bather, which is her, of course. The rest did not see her, but she saw them and loved them. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran, this is where we get into the softcore porn part of it now, you know, the ladies porn. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed all over their bodies. Notice how you see the sunlight glistening off their wet skin. Notice how you see how cut their muscles are as the little streams of water run between the cuts of the muscles. This is really good. He's making you see. That's what a good writer does. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies, her hand, of course. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. Now, if you got a hand that starts at the temples and it's descending, then it goes to the ribs, clearly we're heading south. The young men float on their backs. Their white bellies bulge to the sun. I think the word bulge is used very deliberately here. I think it's not only their bellies that are bulging. Their white bellies bulge to the sun. They do not ask who seizes fast to them. So at this point in her imagination, she's now there floating. It's great. She's got her whole harem. 28 of these guys floating on their backs, bulging. And she is in her imagination. She is on top of each one of these with her back arching. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray. Thank you. So on one level, it's just guys playing in the river, spraying each other with water. But on another level, it's clearly this is the poem's climactic word. So do finish reading through all of this 52 sections by Thursday. Be working on your poems. Have a lovely day off.